Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 43 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather in front of our radios to exchange information, to learn from each other, to teach each other, and to hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again, for coming back this Sunday night. I hope you are all well. Let me drop for a second, and then I will return with the usual links. Well, the first thing is, if you want to contact me via email, I will give you two email addresses. This would be either for what we call mailbag questions, the questions normally asked during the technical net, but you might not be able to transmit, or if you you have a topic you'd like to discuss, either a topic in the news that you'd like to discuss by yourself or be part of a discussion or hear other people discuss, or if you have a technical puzzle to offer me and I can work it into the TechNet. We're always looking for TechNet puzzles. Or if you have something that you want to tell Paul of US2N, some NASA or space-related story, you can, of course, directly email him at spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email addresses, I'll give you both, is mailbag@ac2gs.com and roy@limarktech.net. We offer a page with a bunch of links, interesting articles and YouTubes that I've seen over the past week. So if you have nothing better to do someday, it's up 24/7. Just type into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net, and that'll take you to our link page. We have a chat room available. It's been rather quiet lately. You can get to it by either typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. And we offer an audio stream of the technical net as well as the Glen Oaks repeater the rest of the week. Type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net, and that will give you the audio stream. And I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. He's had over 1 million visitors. He has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So please check it out one of these days. It's rather fascinating. Let me drop again, and I will return and tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, no particular special topics, but we will, as always, ask people for their questions or comments or topics for discussion. Hopefully the first few should be amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio technical net. But, you know, we will allow any question related to science and technology. That should take us to approximately 10:15, and Paul WS2N will give us the SpaceNet report. That should take us to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the following week. That's the links between them all work. So with that all in mind, if anyone has any questions, comments, or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your call sign, your name, and whether it's a topic or a comment, whether it's amateur radio related or non-amateur radio related.
KG2RY, good evening.
David recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
KE2HAU, I'm Charlie. I like to listen to this show because I learn a lot just by listening.
Okay, Charlie, I'm glad to have you. I heard you call out your call sign. I looked you up in QRZ. You know that they left out your R in your first name. But you're always welcome to ask questions. You learn probably more that way, but I leave that up to you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Kilo 2, Echo, Mike, Tango. Name is Bill, Bravo, India, Lima, Lima. And I'm more than happy to just listen and wondering if anybody has any information about genetics and genetic studies.
Okay, that's a very big topic, Bill. Anything specifically in genetic studies or just the general science?
Pretty general. New book is coming out tomorrow, as a matter of fact. It drops tomorrow, called The Species Serum. And I read, you know, the little blurbs about it on Amazon and everything, and it sounds really interesting, and it's going to feed a lot of questions in my mind.
Okay, Bill. Well, we'll put you down on the list after we get through the amateur radio-related questions. Like I said, I'm open to discuss anything, and I'm not familiar with the book, so you could make me hopefully a little familiar with the book, and we can discuss genetics if you wish. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list tonight, please? Hit that push to talk. Okay, well, let's start with David, KG2RY. What's your question or your comment for tonight, David?
Good evening, Roy. I hope you're having an excellent night. I was listening to some people talk about this, and I posed a question, and then they had their own take on whatever this thing is. The question is, do you know anything about the 4-meter amateur band? 70 megahertz. I would assume that there's very little action in the United States, since the FCC rejected a proposal, you know, for 4 meters to become used for amateur-related communications in the U.S. What do you know about this? Go ahead.
Okay, well, it's kind of all theoretical, unfortunately, because as you mentioned, the FCC does not allow operation of amateur radio operators on the 4-meter band. You can actually rather quickly tell if a particular transceiver is designed to be sold in the United States and Canada versus Europe, because in Europe they do allow, the European Union, I assume, generally allows 4-meter operation. I am a member of the Radio Society of Great Britain. I get their very, very interesting magazine, and there's articles galore about 4 meters there because it's legal. I would assume that it has some characteristics similar to 6 meters, that at best, when propagation conditions are excellent, it can propagate through F2, but for the most part, it's probably very similar to the point-to-point operation of 2 meters. That's approximately what my knowledge entails. I've never had any practical experience. I've never been able to pick up a 4-meter transmission here in Brooklyn, so I don't know any practical knowledge about it. Just what I read in the magazines.
QSL, Roy. Let's say I want to listen on 70 megahertz, but I'm going to go to the band selector, and I'll press 70. It doesn't go there. and it doesn't allow me to even listen on 70 meters. Go ahead.
Well, again, because you're using an American a transceiver designed to be sold in the United States, the FCC doesn't certainly want it to be able to be transmitting at 4 meters, and for sundry reasons, they disable even reception. Although it's perfectly legal to listen on the band, if you happen to have a general coverage receiver, they're a lot more forgiving because they don't have a transmitter stage. They tend to be designed for wide swaths of the HF band. So you might find a general coverage radio or an SDR radio that's able to receive at 4 meters.
Comment.
Yes, Wesley.
Any transceiver that has independently tuned receiver is able to tune to any frequency, usually from 30 kilohertz up to whatever the band is. I believe Kenwood 2000 can go to 1 gigahertz, but I'm not sure. I have two Kenwood 2000s, but 70 centimeters is not a problem. 70 centimeters. 70 megahertz is not a problem.
Okay, it basically depends upon the radio, because it can't legally transmit on that frequency. Some manufacturers take the frequencies completely out of the processor unit, and it's not like Mars bands where you just kind of break off a low resistance resistor, and that allows the processor to be able to work on Mars frequencies. Every so often someone comes by on the technical net and they bought a radio on eBay, failing to notice that it was a European model and that they had some problems with it, among other things. But they were able to receive on 4 meters, but that really didn't help them much. So, I mean, there are a lot of radios out there that can receive on 4 meters that are sold in the United States. I assume yours simply doesn't have that capability.
A VDH with a comment?
John.
Yeah, I have the FRG, the FRG 9600 by Yaesu. It's a relatively old receiver. I bought it back in the late 80s. Actually, mid-80s, it tunes 60 to 905 megahertz, old cellular bands included. As a matter of fact, years ago, I used to listen to some cellular phone calls, but that's another story. Anyway, this I have tuned the range of around 70 megahertz. Recently, I hear very little up there. Years ago, going back 10 or 15 years, there used to be quite a bit of paging activity, but most paging transmitters now have pretty much disappeared, so there's not much activity there. Of course, that is between old TV channels 4 and 5. Channel 4 was 66 to 72, and channel 5 was 76 to 82, so that range from 72 to 76 megahertz was the, I guess, would be 4 meters. So there's very little activity there now that I can hear. But as I say, going back 15, 20 years ago, I did used to hear quite a bit of paging transmitters there. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, John, thank you for that. Yeah, like I said, for whatever reason, the United States decided not to give 4 meters to amateur radio operators. Perhaps it was because it was already in use for the paging industry. But Europe has it, and, you know, if you ever take a trip to England or France or what have you, You can take, if you have a radio that is capable of four meters, you know, I'm sure there's some degree of activity. I can't tell you exactly how much locally, but my tendency is to think that most of it is point-to-point. There's not a lot of ionospheric propagation. I, if we had some people from across the pond, they probably could tell me better about the propagation of 40 meters in their environments.
I suspect it behaves a lot like 6 meters, that when you find good activity on 6 meters, the 50 megahertz band, you probably get some activity up there on four meters in the 70 megahertz region. Historically, years and years and years ago, this is going way back now into the 50s, 75 megahertz was used for something I think called a fan marker, where they transmitted the letter Z. Dada did it as a kind of fan marker, but I think that was at 75 megahertz. But of course, that's ancient history. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, being 4 meters, it's probably something like the stepchild of if 6 meters married 2 meters. So I'm not quite sure what the maximum usable frequency tends to be, if it's cut off before you get to four meters or not. But I don't know. Judging from incidental stories when I read my United Kingdom radio magazine, it strikes me that it's a lot more like 2 meters than it is 6 meters. You know, I've never read anyone describing it as a magic band and telling tales of propagation around the world and such. So I think, unfortunately, it gets precariously close to the maximum usable frequency, and so it's more point-to-point locally.
Well, you know, I was watching a YouTube video, and this British ham radio operator was using 2 meters on a HT, and then he was using 4 meters on a mobile radio.
Okay, I mean, again, that makes sense. I don't recall HTs generally using 4 meters. You usually need either a base station or a mobile radio that's kind of designed for HF that includes 4 meters. So it's quite understandable.
The other thing that I was reading is that the width of the band from top to bottom, it's 70 megahertz to 70.5. So you only get a half a megahertz in the width of the entire band compared to 2 meters, which is 144 to 148. So you get 4 megahertz, and then 70 centimeters. I'm not sure exactly what that is.
Well, apparently, I think that there's differing bandwidths according to countries, because I read here that Finland has expanding access. So you know, from country to country, even though I would think that it would be uniform in the European Union, yeah, it's a much more narrow bandwidth than most of the other amateur radio bands. But, I mean, we have a very narrow bandwidth on 60 meters as well, so there's nothing that special about that.
QSL, and it's also true about 17 and 12 meters.
Yeah. There are bands that are wide open, like 70 centimeters. It's so wide that you could theoretically fit some television transmissions, you know, within it. But most of the other bands are relatively narrower, and some are very narrow. We, you know, remained after all the big boys took their frequency allocations.
KG2RY. Yeah, it's like on 15 meters and on 10 meters, you're like in the wilderness.
Yeah, they're all kind of thankfully different, so it gives you the choice of wandering about. Some people, I assume, like channelized bands, so that's great for them. Others like wide open spaces, and others like narrow little places where it's easier to find people on the narrow bands than on the wide bands. They have to twirl that VFO a lot longer to get to the other end of it, like 10 meters.
QSL. Well, thank you, Roy. I really do appreciate your interest and your knowledge, and I'll be listening on the side. This is KG2RY.
Okay, very good, David. Thank you again for participating tonight. We still have some openings if people want to ask anything the topic related to amateur radio. So if you're out there and you have a question about amateur radio, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions that people have, it's just a matter of asking them here. So with that in mind, please hit that push to talk and give me your name and whether you have a question or a comment.
Jim K, PhD, with a
question.
Radio question.
Down here at Cape Cod, Florida. The handle is John, Juliet Ocean Hotel, November. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, John, you doubled almost identically with Jim. So I guess we'll take Jim first, and then we'll take you, John. Is that okay?
Fine by me. Back to that control.
Okay, Jim, what's your question or comment for tonight?
Good evening. Coming in late. I just got into the shack. Years ago, I remember hearing about something called ground wave, and the there was descriptions and diagrams of ground wave as distinct from line-of-sight communication and star wave and skip and whatnot. Where the wave is vertical and it travels not straight out from the transmitter, but it curves with the shape of the Earth. It hugs the ground and it curves to some distance. So I'm not talking about skip. I'm not talking about reflecting off the ionosphere, and I'm not talking about direct. I'm talking about a curved propagation. Does this exist on any of the bandwidth that we have access to, or other bandwidth, or anybody have any knowledge to share on that type of propagation, if I remember it correctly, if it even exists?
AC2GS. No, Jim, it does exist. It sort of depends what you mean by it. If you mean the relatively intriguing long-distance signals that travel by ground wave propagation and kind of hug the interface between the Earth and the atmosphere, you're probably alluding more to the AM broadcast band. There are clair channel stations that the FCC allows to operate at incredibly high power ratings where, you know, in the middle of the night with an AM radio, you can listen to stations that are many hundreds of miles away. To a degree, you know, ground wave is what you would probably consider direct contact, point-to-point contact. When I'm operating on the 10-meter net, the way that I hear people locally is not through skywave propagation through the ionosphere, because by the time it bounces off the F1, F2 layers, it's hundreds of miles away. That's what gives you that kind of skip type of situation. So those are really ground wave propagations. They don't really demonstrate hugging the surface of the Earth as much as a lower frequency AM broadcasts do. But in a matter of speaking, they are ground wave propagations. The primary two methods that transmissions make are ground wave propagations. Also, they could be considered point-to-point. Or skywave propagations, which use the ionosphere to refract around the Earth and bounce up and down and get you that distance.
Coming.
Yes, Wesley?
When you described ground wave, you said it's a interface between Earth and the atmosphere. By atmosphere, we understand air. So the interface is between Earth and air. And that substitutes the description of surface wave, which you denied, or at least didn't agree with. And to exhale.
I didn't deny a surface wave. I don't deny surface wave. Most likely I won't deny surface wave. I deny the properties that you think will work. You think that the Earth can operate as a near-perfect waveguide and have limited loss. I think the Earth atmosphere interface is not perfect. It can be lossy, but I totally believe that there are surface wave phenomena at the interface. But can you use them to transport massive amounts of electrical energy from one place on the surface of Earth to another place on the surface of the Earth at relatively low to no loss? I don't think so. I think that kind of defies a whole bunch of basic laws of physics. That's my problem.
And takes you here to the comment. Well, the surface wave is divided by number of waves, or depends on the frequency used, and polaritons. Surface wave is also described in the form of Zener wave. And that is supported by science. In 2020, you can look at the Wikipedia, Zener wave. Dr. Origami provided practical experiment, and it is mentioned in Wikipedia. With the light bulbs used as loads, so 5-year-old child could see that it works. And you can refer to that. Thank you.
Well, Wesley, with all due respect, I could show you and cite you documentation that those strange little people in Korea had a room temperature superconductor. You know, lots of luck with trying to do that. It's not whether one person reports it; it's whether it's reproducible, which his isn't, as was the case of the room temperature superconductors. There's a lot of mistakes made in science, and just because someone made it and wrote it down don't mean that it's real. So, again, every time a legitimate professor does anything that even vaguely touches on so-called Zenic waves, they have this unfortunate tendency to call them so-called Zenic waves, which leaves me to believe that there is a lot of questions in that particular area. So although you can cite me one study or one guy who's invested all of his money in research and development and then went bankrupt, those are biased people. The idea of science is to get the same results from people whose profession does not hinge on the report of something that's very dubious, like a room temperature superconductor.
VHD, redirect.
Certainly, Jim.
Okay.
Yes. Wesley?
Well, I was trying to say something. I'm sorry. Did I interrupt somebody? I was trying to respond to your comment. Can I do it?
We will certainly give you time, but Jim was the guy who originated the question, and I think he should be able to talk. So after he's finished, we'll get back to you. I know you fervently believe in Zenic waves and such. So, Jim, what would you like to say?
As much as I do enjoy hearing the Tesla ideas, because I think it's interesting, I don't think we really get everything he was after. That's not where I was going at all with this. I'm pretty sure it was like in a republication of some sort of military bulletin or something like that, which may have been incorrect. I mean, that does happen. But the waveform that they described was, like I said, vertically polarized, and best I could tell, they weren't saying it was interacting with the atmosphere. It was just hugging the Earth, as if the waveform was being, like, bent or refracted by the toe of the waveform dragging on the Earth. I mean, I'm using physical principles to describe an electronic thing, and it's a question. It's not an answer, I guess is what I'm saying. The diagram showed the wave kind of dragging on the ground level, and so gently curving around the Earth for some distance, for a medium distance communication. It sounds like the AM may do that. Is there any bands or stuff that we have access to that has those properties, even a little bit?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I would wonder whether we could manifest that using the 160 meter band. That's kind of closest to the broadcasting frequencies that we can get. Also, you know, recently the FCC has allowed us to do experimental work in ultra low frequencies. So you might be able to manifest those type of transmission qualities using ultra-low. It's still highly experimental. The principle behind why it kind of hugs the ground is not solely related to the ground. It's related to the ground and the atmosphere acting as somewhat of a means of containing. It's a waveguide, approximately, and the air is a dielectric material, and the Earth is a partial conductor. So, you know, if you didn't have the dielectric effect of the atmosphere, you wouldn't have the waveguide type of phenomena. So the two are kind of intertwined in the phenomena as far as I understand.
So I'm wondering if anybody in our ether, as it were, has any knowledge of this type of propagation as it relates to our pursuit.
JD2 TRG with a comment?
Yeah, sure.
Good evening, Roy. Yeah, I used to work for a company out here on Long Island, and we did OTH, which is the over the horizon early warning radar system for the Army. And the ground waves, for the Navy, and ground waves basically propagate best over water. And we were operating in the 2 to 20 megahertz band. That was strictly military. They also will use it. It's sort of a ground wave communications for the submarines. And they'll go VLF, LF, and ELF. For talking to the deep water subs. But basically, the OTH used a lot of, ground wave propagation. And like I said, we operated 2 to 20 megahertz, KD2 to TRG.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because if you're looking for something with a consistent conductivity, The Earth has conductive areas, but it also has dielectric material in it, whereas salt water is kind of the ultimate uniform conductive material. So you have the seawater below, you have the air above, and I guess you have a decent waveguide that's you know, kind of curving the RF in the general direction of the globe. So it makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
That would seem to point towards the 160, you mean, is, like you were saying, Roy, that might have some possibilities.
And WS2N.
Yes, Paul. Yeah, I tend to think that it works far better at in the lower spectrums of the frequency allocations. As was mentioned earlier, the ultra-low and very low frequencies of submarines. Paul, you want to say something?
I would say 80 meters, you know. I mean, practically every night, you know, outside of the summertime, but every night I can get on 80 meters and, you know, work upstate, work Canada, work a lot of Pennsylvania, Virginia, you know, and those waves, you know, are not bouncing off the ionosphere. That's following the ground. So I would say 80 meters is qualified. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, do you find that that type of propagation, though, is consistent or somewhat erratic?
Definitely consistent. I find myself working sometimes the same people, you know. I get on a week later, it's the same guy, you know. I get on CW and, you know, 3.038, and it's the same guy I talked to a week ago. You know, I would say it's consistent. And, you know, even on phone. Back to you.
Okay, very good. And even on 10 meters, we had a person on our net who usually would drive to right in front of a big body of water and then transmit portably, and his signal was always better when he did that. So transmitting real close to a body of water probably helps ground wave propagation at any band. I think it tends to help as you get lower and lower in the spectrum, but pretty much anything, I haven't really heard of, even 2 meters, the ductal weather inversion will produce a duct. People on the West Coast during weather inversions can talk as far as Hawaii, so that's not quite ground wave propagation. That's a slightly different thing, but still, bodies of water can kind of give you a little bit more range.
I think Paul's description, if he's working horizontally polarized, is probably NVIS, but if he's working vertically polarized, I would agree with him. What do you say, Paul, on your antenna configuration?
My antenna is so low, it kind of qualifies for both vertical and horizontal. But, I mean, there's no way. I don't have this way up in the trees. So, it's, you know, I mean, it's set up for horizontal. But I think I'm pretty much getting out of vertical. Now, I'll notice that, you know, let's say I'm working Pennsylvania all the time, no matter what I do, or, you know, within, let's say, 400 miles, three or 400 miles. You know, then there'll be a space. I won't get anything beyond that, you know. The next thing you know, I'll be working Indiana or Michigan. You know, that to me is a sky wave. I'm getting that. But in between, let's say, Michigan and western New York, there's nothing. I'm getting nothing. So that tells me that the nearest stations are probably ground waves. That's what I'm guessing at. Back to you.
From what I've been studying about NVIS propagation, I think your nearest stations are probably that. the sky wave, the ground wave I'm talking about would be mainly a vertically polarized phenomena, and I think what you're talking about is NVIS, is what you're describing. But I'm out of the limb here. So, like I said, this is a question, not an answer.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I think it's got to qualify. It's got to some degree ground wave, especially locally. I mean, you know, if I get on, I could work New Jersey, you know, every night of the week on 80 meters. You know, it's got to, that part has to be ground wave. We'll see. Very good. Roy, I want to turn back to you. WS2N.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I don't know. It's very difficult to separate the two qualities. A near vertical incident sky wave kind of gives you the same local effect that ground wave propagation does. So other than manipulating the antenna to cancel out the near vertical incident sky wave component, you don't really know. It's a percentage type of thing. So is it... you know, 10% near vertical incident sky wave and 90% ground wave propagation, you don't really know until you've canceled out one of them and made proper measurements.
I think the biggest tell is one will go over a mountain and the other one won't.
I guess so, but it can, you know, under some circumstances, it tends to hug the landscape and kind of goes around it. So unless you got a big mountain really close by, you know, if you're sitting in a valley, then you sort of know when you're going near vertical incident sky wave. As the land kind of flattens out and the hills and mountains get farther and farther away, it becomes less obvious what's going on.
I guess what really leads me to all this is I live on the South Shore of Long Island, just south of the Selden repeater antenna. And the Selden repeater antenna sits on top of the terminal moraine, which basically creates an RF wall between me and Connecticut, let's say. So I explore different ways to get over that wall, and repeater works very effectively, but it is infrastructure. So I always try to look for ways to do it otherwise. And I don't think the ground wave will, but it brings up a whole interesting host of the knowledge that was intriguing to me. Thank you for addressing it.
Well, you're welcome, Jim, as always, for participating. Wesley, I told you I wanted to have Jim, you know, get his question answered as best he can. I really don't want to go into a long chat about Zetic waves again. It gives me a rash. But, you know, if you want to kind of say a couple of words to wrap it up, that's fine.
Yeah, the subject is not new. We were talking about it in 2015-17. And in 2020, Professor Dr. Saitan Organ, the new guy, the young fellow. He was in University of Korea, South Korea, then engineer in chief designer in Indian Institute of Technology, and in University of Science and Technology in Gansu, Republic of China, as a full professor. He's credited with pioneering work with field of Zenic waves based on wireless power transmission, most notably for practical presentation of it. The description that you provide as an atmosphere and the interface is sort of two-dimensional interface that describes surface wave and surface plasma polaritron. It is supported by science that in millimeter waves, as far as this device that was working on 20 kilohertz, and I'm not trying to argue about that, and I'm not trying to make a long comment about it. It's just something that needs more information about it, but how could you justify the difference between ground wave and surface wave when you gave the description of the surface wave? Thank you.
No.
Well, again, I have nothing against the concept of surface waves. I have problems with your Zenic waves. I have a lot of problems with Chinese science. Chinese science kind of makes stuff up all the time. You know, if you go to China, apparently they're the masters of fifth generation cellular towers and artificial intelligence and all kinds of things that they decidedly aren't. Most of their technology is just rip-off copies of American and old Russian. They have a lot of public relations bluster, but the science doesn't hold up about almost anything. So, I always try and keep an open mind. When they actually have something to show someone, I will look and investigate it. Right now, it's just kind of vaporware. In my humble opinion, and you are perfectly free to have your differing opinion.
I do thank you very much. This guy is not Chinese, and he graduated in the United States of America. Thank you very much. Oh, check in Wikipedia. About Zenic Wave, that is a 2020 practical Zenic Wave experiment they talk about.
Yes, but he works in China, so he unfortunately gets painted with the same brush that a lot of claims that don't exist in reality get painted with. Again, we will see. We have chatted about this for many years now. We will hopefully be healthy enough to chat about this for many years to come. Do I think there will be a breakthrough? No. Do you think that there will be a breakthrough? You probably think there already has been a breakthrough. Again, we agree to disagree.
Thank you very much for your time.
And you are welcome as well. John, I can't find your call sign here, who had a question tonight. What's your question? And if you give me your call sign again, please.
Hi, good evening, Roy. King Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa, John. We're in Cape Cod, Florida, Southwest Florida. My question, the other day I was sitting in the car, I'm picking up my granddaughter at school, and I was speaking to one of the school safety officers. They had the two-way radio system upgrade on 460 megahertz. And I noticed a lot of static and intermittent transmissions. So I said to the gentleman, I said, you know, what's going on with your radio system? And he said, I don't know, it's been wacky for the last couple of weeks now, and intermittent and everything. So I just happened to look up at the roof, because I had a clear view of it, and I noticed that their antenna, the wire connected to the antenna, was hanging. And that's probably previous from the storm, and it probably just blew off, hanging in the air. My question is, what does it do to the base station, being that they're operating the radio without having an antenna? Does the coax act as a free line or a dummy load at that point, and what damage does it do to the radio?
Okay, well, it primarily has to do with the power output and the design parameters of the radio in question. Transmitter circuits tend to want to feed into a 50-ohm impedance. They're all kind of designed that way. They don't have an internal 50-ohm impedance, but they're designed to output to a 50-ohm impedance. If not, they reflect the power back. Poorly designed transmitters with reasonably high power ratings will then reflect power back on the circuits and could burn out the final transistors. Most modern-day transmitters do have open and short protections where they'll fold over the output power, drop it to a tenth or a twentieth of its power, and protect the circuits. So it sort of depends upon the safety features designed into the final transmission circuit of the radio.
Okay, well, that answered my question. As I was saying, you know, their transmissions are fairly short. You know, it's a school, so it's not like, you know, kids coming from one class and going to another and everything. You know, now with the sign of the times that everybody's being watched and guidance and being checked on. And their transmissions are not very long, like, you know, we do on AM radio. You know, it's, Jerry's going to room 205, you know, but they're off the radio. And most of their equipment is Motorola, so I did verify that. Just a gentleman having a handy talking to Motorola. But the base station, like I said, is in the main office in the lobby, so to speak, where the faculty stay. All right, thank you very much. They are going to get somebody out there to reconnect to a co-op, but they have to, since all the safety guards, they got to get a forklift. They won't let anybody go up on the roof with a ladder. And the antenna is accessible. Somebody could just go up there and allow to hook up the coax, but, safety precautions and all the rules and regulations. No, they're going to have somebody come in with a forklift and send somebody up there to reconnect it. All right, thank you. Back to, I kind of figured so, because the transistors are short and they use a Motorola equipment. It's a lot more, designed better than what we use for amateur radio, so to speak. Thank you for the comeback. Back to Mr. Trollwood.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, I mean, it's very possible, depending upon where the break is, that it's sort of reflecting back on the coaxial cable and acting as a common mode antenna. Not terribly high efficiency, not exactly 50 ohms, but enough output power to produce some kind of transmission. I mean, I tell this story regularly. On my 10-meter net, a person who's about 3-4 miles away from me, just as a lark, we connected both of our antennas to our dummy load, and the dummy loads are supposed to isolate the signal entirely, but they're not all perfect, and so they do leak. And we were able to have a great conversation by just using our dummy loads as antennas for the purpose of reaching each other. So, it's surprising what a well-engineered piece of equipment will tolerate.
Okay, Roger, very good, Roy, and I always enjoy the net. I tune in whenever I can. Sometimes I can't get in. The echolink won't allow me, but that's, I don't know for whatever reason. I brought a scanner with me and tried to figure out their frequency. I know they're on the 460 megahertz, but I can't seem to pin down the frequency they're on, even though they list all the frequencies in Lee County. Well, for some reason, that particular school, they don't have it listed. So I sit there while I'm waiting for my granddaughter. I try to scan up and down on the 460 band, try to pick out which frequency they're on. But so far, I haven't caught the fish. Because their transmissions are not that long, so, it's not like they're carrying a long piece. But it's just something to do while I'm waiting online, nothing that I want to listen to them regularly. It's just something to pass the time, so to speak. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I understand. It's a challenge. I assume that they don't use more esoteric means like trunking transmissions and such where, they jump from frequency to frequency and such. But, yeah, it's just the fact that they transmit for such a short duration. You know, by the time you approach that region of the frequency, they've already unkeyed. So, that's been known to happen. Okay, very good, John. Again, I appreciate your participation. Hope everything in Florida is going lovely, and I hope in future you'll come by with some other questions or comments for the net.
Okay, roger that. King Bravo 2, I forgot a par, and we'll be listening here for the rest of the net until we finally fall off.
Okay, hopefully Echo Link. You know, Echo Link works in mysterious ways. I think it's set for a certain number of people, and when too many people show up, it gets a little nervous and drops people off. Anyway, continues to be AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. We still have one question loaded for from Bill about genetics, but if anyone has any amateur radio-related questions before we get to that, please hit that push to talk. Give us your call sign.
W2BZ.
Okay, Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
Well, I tuned in to, on my SDR, I tuned in to 10 meters today, and to my surprise, there were a lot of signals on. There was some kind of contest going on. So I switched from my mag loop to my shortened N-fed halfways and spoke to a guy in Texas who said that my audio was distorted. Now, I did hear the audio coming through my stereo speakers a little bit, which of course means RF, but the antenna shows great SWRs around 10 meters, so I'm confused as to why it would cause RF to get into my radio. I do have two toroids wound, you know, as sort of ununs or one-to-one balance, and I still get this report. It is going through a tuner, which is, I need to go through a tuner for the N-fed halfways, and so it is going through a tuner, but I mean, I can't put any more toroids on there. What else is there?
Okay. N-feds are infamous for producing common mode RF all over the place, including one shack. If you feel that you don't have any more room on your transmission line to create another RF choke, you might want to create an RF choke at the end of your microphone cable going in to the connector of your radio. You get yourself a toroid and just wrap the last foot or so of your microphone cable around and around and around the toroid, and that will block the RF from getting into your microphone amplification circuits in your radio.
You know, I did do that in the past, and this problem with RF on 10 meters, I was talking to Andy about it about a year ago, I guess, or less than a year ago. And I forget when he passed, actually. And he was talking about, I forget now what he thought might be the problem. He was going to take a look at it for me, but that never happened. So it sounds like RF feedback, and I'll try again. If 10 meters is doing well again, I'll try to wrap another toroid with the mic cable, but I think it's something more than that. I don't think it's coming down from the mic. I think it has something to do with the tuner. Don't know what.